Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the consequences of change and how today's choices impact tomorrow's community. This program is an extension and production of Action for Healthy Communities and provided in collaboration with KCBX. It is made possible through underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. Chris Kington Barker is today's host, and she'll be talking with local guests to discuss the importance of International Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Awareness Day, which helps raise awareness about the range of conditions that can result from alcohol use during pregnancy. You're invited to listen, learn, and participate in the conversation by calling your questions or comments at 805-549-8855 or emailing them to voices@kcbx.org. Here's your host today, Chris Kington Barker.
Thank you, Francisco. Alcohol is the leading preventable cause of birth defects and developmental disorders in the United States. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports an estimated 1 in 8 women drinks during pregnancy, putting her child at risk. And as a result, every year, thousands of infants are born with disabilities because they were exposed to alcohol in the womb. Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders, or FASD, Awareness Day, held yearly on September 9th, is a reminder that there is no safe level of alcohol while present. Judge Charles Crandall, Superior Court of San Luis Obispo County, and Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, Medical Director for the Suspected Abuse Response Team and Pediatric Consultant for Martha's Place Children's Assessment Center, have joined me today as guests. If you do miss a portion of today's show, it is recorded and will be archived on KCBX's website. Welcome, Dr. Abdul-Qadir, and welcome Judge Crandall. I keep wanting to make you a doctor too today, so I'll try to stop that.
That's okay. If you want to make me a doctor, I'll be happy with both designations.
So we're talking about something medical, so it only is appropriate. You know, while when we get started, I want to talk a little bit about, if you could please, Dr. Abdul-Qadir, if you could talk about the difference between fetal alcohol syndrome, which we've heard about for decades and decades, and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. What's the differentiation between the two?
Okay, thank you. And thank you for allowing us to be on the program today. We're very happy to be here today sharing on this Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders Awareness Day, the 9th of September, representing the 9 months of pregnancy. And so we have the name of the day, FASD day. And so fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is an umbrella term. It's not a diagnosis. This is an umbrella term to describe the variety of diagnoses that we may find under this umbrella. So under fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, we do have fetal alcohol syndrome. That is the most severe form of this disorder from the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure. And that is seen in probably less than 1% of our population, but getting close to 1%. Then when we look at all of the other potential neurobehavioral, neurodevelopmental issues that can arise from prenatal alcohol exposures, those would be considered the other areas on the fetal alcohol spectrum disorder spectrum, which can affect 1 to 5% of school-aged children, as we're seeing, but maybe up to 10% in some higher risk populations. And some studies that are coming out of juvenile justice systems show somewhere between 10 and 20% of individuals in those systems affected by prenatal alcohol exposure.
And I would imagine that what Dr. Abdul-Qadir just shared is how you come into play here, Judge Crandall. It's you're seeing them in the justice system, kind of a fallout that's occurring, correct?
Well, that's a great question, Chris. So the issue is we're not seeing them in the sense that, and this is sort of what got me so interested, the data that Dr. Abdul-Qadir just talked about is very high in juvenile justice that has, where it has been studied in San Diego, for example. And yet there's basically nobody that I've seen over the 3.5 years I've been as a juvenile justice judge who's had that diagnosis. They have other diagnoses. Oh. And the problem is that what you see are the behaviors, and it's interesting, what they say is, if you have tried medications and you have tried therapy and you have tried different approaches for modifying behaviors and none of it's working, it's like that is a red flag that you might be dealing with one of the FASDs. And so, great question. The answer is, the same is true in dependency or juvenile protection court, where I've seen lots of children who are acting out, who have been, they've tried all sorts of things and nothing has worked. And there again, have not seen any kids on either side of the juvenile system who have that diagnosis. And that grabbed my attention big time.
Dr. Abdul Qadir, can you talk about the symptomology that Judge Crandall is discussing kind of generally? What is happening with the children that is going either mistreated or untreated?
Sure, absolutely. And just to speak on that mistreated component, there were some studies that came out, particularly in children in the foster care setting, that are misdiagnosed without having a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder diagnosis. They are a group that is more likely to be diagnosed with another reason for their behaviors and symptoms. But generally, what we understand, the areas of behavior or development that we see mostly likely affected are three areas. So one area we would consider neurocognitive. So neurocognitive, we think about things like IQ, about learning, memory, executive functioning, and visual spatial type of awareness. The other area, the second area, would be in self-regulation. So our ability to sleep, how we're eating, how we regulate our emotions, how we respond to transitions or being told no, all of those sort of self-regulation areas. And then the last area that's particularly noted to be involved are adaptive skills. So difficulties in following the daily routines, and those could be related to hygiene, to daily life skills. And as you can imagine, as a child who has had these effects from prenatal alcohol exposure grows, those adaptive skills become more detrimental if they're not able to gain those, and the self-regulation skills as well become more problematic, particularly in the, in the social situation and in the school situation. What we're finding with the neurocognitive areas, there are certain areas that almost can do this. We can almost see, as a child gets older, a fingerprint for fetal alcohol exposure, prenatal alcohol exposure, because many of these children actually score with typical IQs. And so they're not intellectually delayed, and they do not qualify for the services that somebody who was intellectual disabilities might qualify. And this is one of the really challenging components, is where do these individuals fit in for services? Because if their IQ is normal, in that normal range, but they do not have the other skills to be able to perform and to function at that IQ level, they need the support of somebody with a lower IQ, even if that number comes out. But what we end up seeing is sort of this, what we might consider a Swiss cheese approach to their IQ, where there are some areas that are robust and in the typical range, but other areas that definitely fall behind.
Judge Crandall, did you want to add something to this?
Just on top of what Dr. Abdul Qadir said, so in the most extreme, but we see the most extreme, in terms of self-regulation, she said, is,
yes.
A lot of these people sadly wind up on death row, let's just say, and in juvenile justice, because the diagnosis can be mistaken, say, for antisocial personality disorder or conduct disorder. And they say, this guy just does it because he wants to do it, without ever looking at, hey, was he exposed prenatally in the womb to alcohol, which, by the way, doesn't have to be that much. And maybe that's a good segue to get into
that was
what good. risky what is risky drinking? You know, because there's a huge misconception about that.
Yeah, we're not talking about someone who is drinking constantly or has been diagnosed or self-diagnoses themselves as a problem drinker, right?
Right. I mean, and the levels, you know, that can result in problems, you know, I talk about, and this again, we could cross over a little bit into what are obstetricians, what kind of advice is going out in the community to a pregnant woman about drinking, but there's a misconception that says, hey, a glass of wine every day is not going to hurt anybody. Well, in fact, over a period of 2 weeks, if you're having a glass of wine every night, you're in the danger zone right there. So 2 weeks of having a drink every night, you're in the danger zone. Similarly, if there is what we call binge drinking, where you have three drinks, it only takes two binges, get in the danger zone of what we call risky drinking. And to top it off, a lot of women don't realize they're pregnant, it can happen before they know they're pregnant.
Right, right.
And I'd like to just add in too, there's just so much individual difference in how our body responds to alcohol, how we metabolize the alcohol, how it then is transferred over to the developing fetus. So, we really have that message out. There's no known amount that is a safe amount of alcohol during pregnancy. And for people who think or plan to get pregnant, since you don't know when that might happen, don't drink during that period as well, because it can happen. And it is really in that first trimester and those earliest days of conception where the effects of prenatal alcohol exposure lead to the most severe form of FAS, because that's when there's the toxic effect of the alcohol on the developing embryo. The cells are not able to migrate the way they need to migrate. And that's what ends up with the facial features that we see with FAS, as well as the structural brain differences we see with FAS. The continued alcohol consumption or alcohol consumption in the second and third trimesters do not lead us to those facial findings and the structural brain changes, but they will lead to brain connectivity and neurogenesis issues, which then lead to these issues with how the brain is functioning later on.
So really, fetal alcohol syndrome, it really is the first trimester, which, as you were saying, Judge Crandall, is when a lot of women do not know that they are pregnant.
Right, but it keeps going throughout. In other words, yeah. I think I heard Dr. Abdul-Qadir say that you may not have the facial features, but you can easily get the same neurodevelopmental problems, which are just as bad. And in fact, it's far more difficult to diagnose those cases because you don't see the facial features, and there they are, and you're wondering what's wrong with this kid. You know, he or she is not, you know, doing well in math, or is acting out in school, or punching people, or getting into trouble all the time. And you're going, well, what's, you know, and what we've been doing is sort of shaking our heads in a sense, because one of the links we need is prenatal alcohol exposure. Well, when someone's 15 or 16 and winds up in juvenile justice, can you go back in time and get that data reliably?
Yeah. Well, what is the most at-risk population here in San Luis Obispo County for fetal alcohol syndrome or for this disorder, the spectrum disorder? Dr. Abdul-Qadir?
Well, we have been, the public health department has been following the 4Ps Plus, which is a prenatal screening in women in all of the OB clinics across the county. So not just Medi-Cal clinics and in private clinics as well. And what we are seeing as far as the prenatal alcohol risk is in the white college educated population in this county. So that as far as the risk of a woman having consumed alcohol and exposing her fetus, that's the highest risk. Then as far as when it comes to thinking about which children are most at risk, so that would follow the population that's maybe that is consuming the alcohol. But then I find in my experience that then the ones that are most at risk are the ones later on that aren't identified, because they will end up with more consequences of the neurodevelopmental changes that have taken place. And so some of those end up, like Judge Crandall is saying, in the juvenile justice system. Many of them are picked up in the school system as well, but they're not given the correct diagnosis because it is so hard to find. So we may see kids that are being diagnosed with ADHD, kids that are being diagnosed on the autism spectrum, some kids that maybe are in the foster system or adoptive system that are diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder. Well, maybe they have some of these symptoms, but maybe the underlying diagnosis is actually related to the prenatal alcohol exposure.
I want to come back to that in just a moment. I'm Chris Kington Barker with you for Central Coast Voices on KCBX, your Central Coast listener-supported radio station. The voices you hear with me today are Judge Charles Crandall, Superior Court, San Luis Obispo County, Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, Medical Director for Suspected Abuse Response Team and Pediatric Consultant for Martha's Place Children's Assessment Center. They're here to share information about the importance of fetal alcohol syndrome spectrum disorders held, and this is Awareness Day, held yearly on September 9th. It's a reminder that there's no safe level of alcohol while pregnant. If you have questions for today's guests or comments about our topic, we welcome you to call 805-549-8855, or you can email us at voices@kcbx.org. You were talking, Dr. Abdul-Qadir, a little bit about the misdiagnosing that goes on. When individuals are misdiagnosed, when they're given medication for, say, ADHD, is there a negative effect from that medication on those individuals, other than the fact that it doesn't work? And what is some of the impact that you're seeing, or Judge Crandall, you're seeing from the misdiagnosis?
Well, I would say, first of all, from the misdiagnosis is the, when we come up with a diagnosis from a medical construct, it's to help guide treatment, and it's helps guide our trajectory of how we expect someone to either respond to the medications, the therapies that are then prescribed to them. And so with a misdiagnosis, there may be a significant amount of frustration from the parents, from the child, from the therapist, from everybody involved, because the child is just not responding. And so is it because they're not getting their medication? Is it because they're not attending? What else is going on? So a thorough and appropriate psychological evaluation done by somebody who has experience in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders is really helpful to help tease out the correct diagnosis. What's important to understand is these FASD diagnoses are a combination of both psychological evaluation and medical evaluation, because there are medical physical components as well as psychological components, which are found through psychological testing. So I think that's one of the most important things. As far as medication, sometimes medication can be helpful, and sometimes there are some medications that tend to work better for fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. But when we think traditionally about ADHD, the first line treatments are stimulants. And for somebody who does not have the neurotransmitter issue that we see specifically in ADHD, it may lead to more anxiety and aggression in a child with fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. So there can be definitely side effects. And then usually, there's a period of time where there's a trial with the medication. Sometimes the dose is increased because we wonder, maybe it's a higher dose that will work.
Right.
But just like I think Judge Crandall started the hour talking about, when you see kids who've tried medicine after medicine and therapy after therapy, and they're just not responding, this is when you think about it. And he's completely correct with that.
Judge Crandall, before we came on air, I had asked you how you got involved in all of this, and you were telling me a story of how that came about. Would you mind repeating that for listeners? Because I think that's really important.
I'd be happy to, Chris. So I was in San Diego having dinner with my brother-in-law, who is a world-leading expert in fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. And I was telling them how awful it was that I was seeing so many kids who were coming into the NICU with methamphetamine withdrawal, heroin withdrawal, and a whole variety of other drugs. And he looked at me and said, well, alcohol's much worse. And I said, get out of here. And that started a discussion. And the immediate takeaway from the conversation was that, you know, the effect on the brain is permanent. Kids can suffer side effects from exposures to other substances, but they're pretty resilient and they can get through it and they can have a pretty normal life afterwards. All things considered, that's not true with alcohol exposure. And so, and just to echo what, and so that got me involved because I wasn't seeing that in any of the children that I was dealing with, seeing that diagnosis. And since it's so prevalent, like on the, let's say 1 to 10% and higher, it's a higher level of kids in the juvenile system. I said, I'm missing something and we must be missing something as a community.
Yeah. Yeah. Dr. Abdul-Khader, is there anything that is effective in any kind of treatment or anything that abates some of the symptoms, some of the outcome of the spectrum?
Right. So the most important component is early identification. And similar to, in the sense, like autism spectrum disorders as well, early identification. So you can start early, early intervention as early as possible to help with those basic developmental skills with professionals such as occupational therapists, physical therapists, and early intervention specialists that can help tailor individualized plans for those children, as well as education for the parents, because I think the more the parents start to understand what the expectations are for their child, the smoother the course forward, the better the understanding. And so that's going to be the early important starts. There are medications as children get older that may help with specifically with those regulation skills. And then there are specific mental health therapies to help with those self-regulation skills as well. Sometimes ABA, which is used in autism, is also helpful for those adaptive skills in the home to help really teach those home-based skills.
And ABA is
applied behavioral analysis. Yeah.
Okay. Judge Crandall, you were going to say something here.
Well, I think the biggest thing, which I'm just going to emphasize, is the frustration factor and understanding. In other words, if you can, if you have somebody properly diagnosed, then the parents can start reducing the expectations and the frustration level can go down. Ditto for probation officers who the kid just isn't, you know, we keep giving him a forward-thinking journaling to work on, and he goes right out and hits somebody, or he goes right out and does something. And the what we do as a society is we tend to up the punishment. You know, okay, that's a bad kid, and so that right. kid's going to spend 180 days at juvenile services center, and that's going to teach that kid, and it does no such thing.
Right.
So understanding it, what Dr. Abdul-Khader said is also true, that we don't have any bread and butter therapy that's going to work magically on kids who are exposed, but there are evolving therapies and there are some treatment programs, I'll say pretty expensive, but that will work. And you can ad lib it with services knowing what you're dealing with. Like if you know that a kid is a FASD kid and is having difficulty solving math problems, you're not going to beat that kid up emotionally, because guess what? That's not going to go away over time. You just have to accept that. And so anyway, yeah.
Yes, doctor.
Yes, and you know, and I think some of that frustration comes in because we really look at this, especially that larger 5%, as an invisible disability. These are kids that look just like every other kid out there, when they're on the playground or walking around. You can't look at them and say, this is an individual with a disability. And in addition to that, there's certain features that we find with FASDs that make it even more complicated, because one is they are kind of known to talk the talk, but not walk. That they are able to have very high expressive language skills, but not as good receptive language skills. And so a lot of times they'll be very good at repeating back exactly what you told them to do or not to do. And then it will be, but they won't be able to show that and perform that. And in the same way with that language and the expressive language, one thing that we see oftentimes too is what we use the term confabulation, but other people would use the term lying, I think, which has a lot more of a moral kind of heaviness to it. But because they are very good at putting things together verbally, but yet maybe not so good with the story or what was coming in, they will a lot of times make up pieces in their own mind of to explain what had happened or to get out of trouble. Another area that we see commonly in this group is naivety, that they are people that are very easy to convince to do something that could cause them a lot of problems, their families a lot of problems. And I think that's another of the routes that, you know, aside from the acting out behaviors, kind of being pulled into things that they just really don't understand, they're getting involved with, which end up leading them to the juvenile justice system.
Well, and it sounds like coupled with impulse control, that's just a really, that's like a hand grenade, right? I mean, as you were talking and you were describing, I had all of these words flying in front of my eyes, like liar, manipulative, chronic, you know, chronic disregard for all of those judgment words that you hear people assigning to difficult to manage youth, if you will, that they end up getting labeled with, and then they end up with surmountable anger as a result of that. It's spiraling.
Well, I wasn't kidding when I talked about death row. I mean, my brother-in-law goes around at, even at this state in the game, dying, and a lot of the people he sees that are still on death row, in fact, have a diagnosis of fetal alcohol spectrum disorder.
Yes. Yes.
So it winds up in really bad places for exactly what Dr. Abdul-Qadir said. You can, be talked into a lot of things and not understand that, guess what, that's life in prison, or you're going to go away for a long time. And if the sentencing judge or the judge who has, doesn't have any idea what this is, you are going to be appalled at the behavior. So,
talk a little bit about, from your perspective, Judge Crandall, of having done study about this as a judge, how has that informed you in terms of any changes in how you approach something differently in your role?
Okay, so that's a great question. I think the biggest thing it's done in my role, as I said, because to my knowledge, I haven't knowingly been working with kids with this diagnosis, but what I have been pounding, and probably the social workers are sick of me doing it and the probation officers, but any time that there is an ability to get information about the prenatal exposure in the womb of a kid, which often is at detention, right? Right when they're removed, to just because the methamphetamine is in the system at the hospital, I say, did you ask the mother and the father about whether they were drinking during the pregnancy? And again, we can get into how that question needs to be asked and the shame that's associated with it. But so I have been beating that drum as hard as I can ever since. And I know that they are starting to ask those questions. And in fact, sometimes I would take a mom in chambers, so to speak, who I thought, surely this mom was drinking during pregnancy. And after you do it in a non-threatening way, they will talk about it because you're trying to get help for the kid and or trying to lay the groundwork in the future for that kid. And so it's a whole art form of doing it. But I would say that's the biggest contribution, if you will, I've been able to make, is to try and help us develop the data for later, because you can't make the FASD diagnosis at birth. I'll defer to Dr. Abdul-Qadir.
Well, we're going to take a break and I'm going to turn it back to Francisco. We'll be back and I want to talk more about that, not shaming and helping to solve some of these issues. Francisco, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Thanks for tuning in for Central Coast Voices. If you have questions you want to have answered, you can send them in to us at voices@kcbx.org or call them in to us at 805-549-8855. Chris Kington-Parker, our conversation continues right now on KCBX.
Thank you, Francisco. Judge Crandall is here from Superior Court of San Luis Obispo. Dr. Nisha Abdul-Qadir, Medical Director for the Suspected Abuse Response Team and Pediatric Consultant for Marda's Place Children's Assessment, are here for the second half of today's show, Central Coast Voices. And, you know, we left off talking a little bit about just the fact that there's so much shame that goes into not only a diagnosis like this, but because we say it is preventable, we never know how much alcohol is going to have a negative impact. I know it, as a parent, when I have done something that has caused harm to my child, I felt just awful. Can we talk about that aspect of, you know, how difficult this has got to be for parents too, to identify that they may have done something without intention to impact the rest of their child's life? And what do we do about it? What do teachers do? What do pediatricians do? How can we help this?
So I think it's really important to understand, to address these type of issues, that providers and professionals have an approach where there's no shame and no blame. And we need to have a very open approach to talking to parents and educating them and coming up with steps forward that are very supportive, and that to make sure that the families that we deal with know that we're there to support them through this process. I feel in general, the paradigm for treating addiction disorders and thinking about things like alcohol use has really changed. And we are looking at some of these uses as in much more of the context of a chronic disease, say something like diabetes, where there's treatment and their lifestyle changes. It takes a combination of both, but that they're both can reside in that healthcare setting. And so that healthcare providers should be able to discuss these difficult topics in a trauma-informed, trauma-sensitive way. so that they can be supportive to their patients and their clients. As you said, this is 100% preventable. And so the most important first step is education. So we really need to be sure that community education is consistent and accessible to all levels of our fertile population, and maybe even before, so that they can start understanding these risks that may, affect a pregnancy at a very early age. Some of the other things I think that are, challenging when we discuss fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, we see a lot of intergenerational FAS, FASDs, so that the mother who has FAS has a child with FASDs, and it can continue generation after generation. So I think that's kind of that education component that's really important within the community. And as Dr. Crandall, as Judge Crandall had mentioned, something about, maybe when a baby's born and they have a urine drug screen that's positive for amphetamines or opioids. Well, we don't do drug screens on alcohol. The only way we get that history is if a mother divulges that to their provider. And so that's where we get it. You know, there are some rare cases where there's a DUI during pregnancy and we find that information out that way. But for the most part, it's not tested for the same way some other substances might be.
Interesting. Judge Crandall.
You're calling it.
We're both doing it now.
both of my parents were doctors. My sister's a doctor. My daughter may become a doctor. So it's okay. I'm rolling with it.
Take it, Doc. Yeah.
In the most immediate sense, if you ask somebody, and this is where I'm talking about data collection. If you ask a mom, were you using methamphetamine? They'll say, well, I did it a little bit and this and that and the other thing. But then if you say, well, did you drink? Well, they usually know enough that the answer to that they want to say is no, absolutely not. However, if you phrase the question differently, in what I say is a less shameful way and a more inquisitive way about saying, look, how far along? Well, so did you drink at all before you knew you were pregnant? What was your drinking pattern? And most people say, oh, well, I did this or I did that. Or, we used to go out and party on the weekends, or maybe I have a drink or two every night during the week, whatever it is. And then the question is, and so how far along were you when you found out you were pregnant? Right. That's also not sort of a shaming question.
Right.
When did you? And they'll usually give that answer. And then you can put two and two together. The other thing is, the spouse or the partner, if there's an alcohol problem, usually that person is not drinking by themselves. Right. So their partner is drinking. So getting information from the male partner about, how often do you drink? And often they'll say, oh my goodness, we drink every night. I'll have five or six beers a night. Well, what was your female partner doing? Probably not sitting there, sharpening her pens or pencils.
So. Yeah. 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 That makes sense. And Dr. Abdul-Kadar, what I wanted to clarify is when you talk about someone who has FASD, who then has a child with FASD, is that because the pattern of drinking during pregnancy continues, or there's something genetic that is passed along?
It's not specifically the genetics, it's the pattern, right? Okay. It's the lifestyle choices. However, we do know that there are some populations with a higher risk of becoming alcoholic, that they have that genetic propensity. But
yes,
when we're seeing that multi-generational, it's that pattern of drinking that continues generation after generation.
What Judge Crandall is talking about in terms of interview techniques in a way that is not shaming, but is inquiring for valid information, because it's certainly not unreasonable that someone would not know they're pregnant when they're drinking early in their pregnancy. I mean, that's not hiding. That's just lack of information for that person. And so Is that something that individuals in the medical field or individuals that are doing interviews for social services or other kinds of child protective services are learning? Judge Crandall, I'll start with you.
So absolutely, yes. And that's sort of one of the things that, you know, the interview technique for probation officers, less, but mostly for social workers, because they're on the scene right at birth. And that's the time you're apt to get the data that will last a lifetime if you can get it. One of the things I think needs to change, I'm going to say it because I'm not a doctor, even though you've been calling me, you know, pediatricians, obstetricians, they need to get with the program. You know, this safe business has got to go like out the window. There is no safe drinking business. And, you know, because as Dr. Abdul-Qadir said, the biggest risk population right now are the, you know, I'm going to say the women who are working, they come home, they want to relax, and they're getting the green light from their obstetrician, perhaps. And that should be a red light. You know, the more data we, and the interesting thing, and this sort of gets into our working group, you know, we have a working group that we'll be meeting after we're done here. And it's a wonderful group of people from all over different spectrums in the community, trying to figure out what's the best approach, because prevention is obviously the number one. I mean, prevention is the answer. It's preventable, you know, some,
right.
Some diseases aren't preventable. This one is. And trying to get that point in the most effective way. Obviously, labeling hasn't worked worth a damn. You know, you might as well, why bother putting it on there? Because it hasn't had any effect at all. But education is huge.
Yeah, Dr. Abdul-Qadir.
I wanted to add too about the, as you were asking about interviews, and I had brought up earlier about the 4Ps plus, that it's being administered through the health, public health department to the different obstetricians. That is an interview, and it has questions asked in the way that are sensitive and has been validated as a tool for obtaining this information, but it also has an intervention associated with it. So the whole program comes with the interview as well as the intervention. So if somebody says, yes, I drink alcohol at this point, then the intervention, the medical provider can then come in and talk about the different types of things that you might be the result of continued alcohol consumption, and what are the different options for treatment. And, you know, so it's not just screening, it's at each step of the way trying to intervene and provide something that can be supportive to decrease the negative outcomes. I wanted to just also add in to those of the people who are not aware, and I think that this is really important because not to get political, but this is a bipartisan piece of legislation that's being presented at the national level. It is called the Advancing FASD Research Services and Prevention Act. That's Senate 2238 and House 4151. That's going to be working to support services, public health prevention, and research programs across agencies within the U.S. Departments of Health and Human Services, Education, and Justice. So that is something that if there are people who are listening today and are interested in how can I help in this process, you can contact your state senator and your national, but the two senators from California, or your representative, to let them know that you support this bill that is being put forward in a bipartisan way.
That's great. With this, I want to go back to talking about if we were to, well, the thing that occurs to me is we live in wine country here in San Luis Obispo County. You know, you alluded to that, Judge Crandall, when, you know, people, women want to go home. They want to be able to have a glass of wine. They want to relax. There's a lot here. What we have over 340 something wineries easily. Is this something that You know, is there believability that just a little bit could in some women have a major impact? Or is it really that we still think as a society, oh no, you know, there has to be a lot. Is wine as unhealthy as distilled liquor for someone? Is beer as unhealthy as distilled liquor? Does it matter what kind of alcohol?
I'm going to say no to that. It doesn't matter. You have a glass of wine or you have a drink, it's going to have about the same alcohol content. You have a beer, it's going to have the same alcohol content. And it's an illusion that there is safe drinking. You know, those numbers I gave on risky drinking, it doesn't take that much. And then you're in the, do you want a child? Do you even want to think about taking a risk of having a child with lifelong defects in terms of school performance, mental health, possible institutional confinement, trouble with the law? I mean, these are some real serious consequences.
Yeah.
I want to add in, there have been some really good public health efforts and collaborations with the wine industry. In particular, one of the examples is in Mendocino County, where the wine industry, some of the family-owned wineries would put up advertisements saying that it's not safe to drink during pregnancy and then from this vineyard. And I think that's a great message that they're able to put it together. It's not that they don't want their business to be supported, but just to keep that message consistent.
Yeah. And Francisco, you have a caller?
Yeah, that's right. It's a similar, sticking to the similar subject of wine culture. A caller from San Luis Obispo wonders if these problems exist in countries like France or Italy, where wine is a huge part of the culture. So sticking to that similar cultural, as in here with our local wine culture here.
So is FASD as prominent as it is in the United States is the question.
Well, I can take a gander at that one. And so my brother-in-law would need to be here, but he's doing a lot of his research in the Ukraine. And the answer is in countries where alcohol is prevalent, say, and even more prevalent than the United States, I'd say the problem is way worse. The problem in the Ukraine, the problem in Russia is enormously more than in the United States, which has also led to a body of research because the population is so much higher, but it's high enough here as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. And Dr. Abdul Qadir, do you have any response from NICU experience for countries like France, Italy, ones that use a lot of wine?
You know, I don't have any specifics on those kind of countries. Specifically countries where the wine is consumed and very typically in family gatherings and in those situations. However, you know, once again, just stepping back to that big picture, we do know that prenatal alcohol exposure in the developing world or the developed world, so what we would consider first world countries, so much of Europe, the United States, the number one cause is alcohol consumption leading to disability. So it's the number one preventable cause of intellectual disability in the developed world. So I don't know the specifics for those particular countries. Yeah.
If someone is listening today and it, you know, what we're talking about resonates for them, it's a mom or a dad who's looking back at their history with their kid and there may have been alcohol consumption during pregnancy, and they're looking at some of what they're seeing in their child and are beginning to associate it with some of the concerns that you've been talking about, what would be the next steps for them?
Well, in the juvenile justice system or the adult system, for example, right? So you quote unquote graduate if you have this problem and it's undiagnosed and you're performing poorly, you know, I would say the first thing is to contact a probation officer or somebody who is involved in the education and maintenance of this person and say, you know what, you need to know this and without shame and say, listen, I know for a fact that my son or my grandson or my relative was exposed prenatally. In fact, you know, the mother was an alcoholic and, you know, and they drank all the time. You know, those are, that information can start the ball rolling. So that's what I would say from a justice point of view, for sure.
Is the justice system as on board with this, Judge Crandall, as you are now, or is this something that is still early for them?
Well, you're going to get me to toot my own horn a little bit, but I will. I give credit to my brother.
I've already called you a doctor and a judge.
So one of the things I've done has tried to educate the bench, and in particular the juvenile bench, about the problem, because the more that judges are informed, they're more likely to say, wait a minute, you know, when they see someone who has these markers of, you know, attention deficit and acting out. And so we gave a program at the Juvenile Law Institute this year, and I hope it becomes a regular program where Dr. Jones really had the floor talking about exactly what we're talking about today to the group of judges who are going to have the most contact with this problem on the ground. But so awareness and education is huge, and getting it to people who can make a difference, you know, in the school system, in the juvenile justice system, very important.
Okay. Dr. Abdul Qadir.
Yes. So I wanted to just take this moment to talk about a community resource that can be used for, you know, concerns about prenatal alcohol exposure as well in children. This is for families or people who are aware of a child that is under five, and they're five and under, and they're looking for resources of any kind. And that is the Slow Help Me Grow program. This is a centralized access hub where any parent who has a child five and under, or grandparent or provider, and even pediatricians can call the centralized access hub and get information on resources, whether it's specifically developmental. Is it about prenatal alcohol exposure and fetal alcohol spectrum disorders, speech, language, childcare? So we're really happy to see this Help Me Grow program, because it really increases accessibility to information to both our families as well as our providers here in our county. After the five-year-old population, probably for children, the pediatrician is going to be the best person to go to. But schools are also a location that is having more education in this area. And so it depends a lot on where the family feels comfortable and has that contact that they feel comfortable speaking more in depth about this issue. Pediatricians are being trained, and the American Academy of Pediatrics has developed a fetal alcohol spectrum disorder toolkit that covers how to ask those sensitive questions, how to come up with referrals, treatment, and then ongoing care, for, such as anticipatory guidance. How, just as you have a toddler and you plan, you know, now you need to safety proof your house. Well, if you have a toddler with FAS, it's going to grow into an adolescent with FAS. What's the anticipatory guidance that you need for that? So the American Academy of Pediatrics has quite a robust toolkit to help pediatricians navigate this really challenging field.
The first, you know, the first task of that is for the parent to perhaps have a way to process that or talk with someone. Is there a resource for a mom that might have some concerns or want to talk with somebody about maybe this did occur? Is there somewhere that they could go?
So again, I think if they have a young child, along with Help Me Grow with services for the child, they can also provide services for a parent as well, or help guide them in a direction, as well as a variety of counseling services that I think general therapeutic services are really helpful, because that's going to help that parent process. And many times we would recommend that not only do we develop individual therapies for the child or adolescent, we develop family therapies that involve the entire family, and then specific therapy and therapeutic support for the parents, particularly the mother that may have been drinking during the pregnancy.
And school counselors may be another resource for people to go to too, to talk to teachers in school perhaps about this may be an issue, especially if they trust them. What would you, you know, if I was to ask what you'd like to see in the next 4 or 5 years happening with this, what's kind of the next steps for you that you'd like to see for this county and the services for this program? Of course, you'd like to see nobody drinking while right. pregnancy exists. That's probably not going to happen right away. What's short of that but would be very helpful? I'll start with you, Judge Crandall.
Well, I think we need to come up with an effective, public education program that hits home, that makes the point that needs to be made, you know, as opposed to putting a label on a bottle. We need to get what we're talking about out there and loud and clear. And really, the alcohol industry could do that. They're capable of doing it and really saying, look, my brother-in-law pointed out there was one bar where they said they had pregnancy test kits outside, you know, that could give you. Well, that's better than a label, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
You don't want to be anywhere near alcohol if you're planning to get pregnant. The problem is there are a lot of unplanned pregnancies. But if you, but getting like if the fear factor out there saying you don't want this and here's what it can mean for your child, and doing it in a way that is effective. And actually, they do have, as I'm thinking out loud about it, there is a short 15-minute video that was one of the most effective that I've seen on this, where they had kids with the syndrome, with the spectrum disorder, and talking with parents and physicians about it in a very unshaming way was really effective. So we need more of that, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Dr. Abdul Qadir.
Yeah, I would just like to say, you know, I'm really happy to see this federal legislation kind of, you know, started on that level. We need to see more on the state level as well as the local level. And I think we really, again, we want to start as upstream as possible. So even if we can't do prevention, that as soon as we know that we're able to stop the alcohol consumption during pregnancy, the early identification, and then the service development. And we have plenty of other public health models. You know, we have smoking cessation and how that's changed in a generation, how many kids are smoking compared to a generation ago. And other areas like our Surgeon General, who's working so hard to decrease adverse childhood experiences by half in a generation. We have those models. We just need to take this to the same model and have the funding to support it moving forward.
Fantastic. I want to thank my guests today, Judge Charles Crandall, Superior Court of San Luis Obispo, Dr. Nisha Abdul Qadir, Medical Director for Suspected Abuse Response Program, and pediatric consultant for Martha's Place Children Assessment Center. Next week, join Fred Monroe and his guest, Central Coast Voices, who's been sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in the San Luis Obispo Community Foundation, in collaboration with KCBX, made possible by underwriting through Joan Geller Sargent. I'm Chris Keaton Barker. Thank you for joining us today.